Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami.
This was supposed to be Ajahn Janaka's night to give a talk, but got switched around by Bungpa since he knows that I'm leaving in a few days. All my calculations about not having to give another talk have been completely subverted. But here we are. Sometimes whenever I give a reflection, it often has to do with some of the things I'm exploring in my own practice, or maybe sometimes some readings that I've been doing, reflecting on, and kind of happens that the past bit of time I've been reading a couple of books that are maybe a little bit less on the actual personal nature of practice or the practice of meditation or some of the more specific teachings of Dhamma, and a little more on the level of not quite sure what they are, I guess societal aspects or maybe trends in the way our minds are working, modern institutions, the difficulties of living in modern times and how the human psyche is responding to them. One of the books that I finally finished, I've been reading it for more than a year because it's pretty dense and big and complex, was a book called The Master and His Emissary, sort of about the divided brain, left hemisphere, right hemisphere, and some of the aspects of the overdevelopment in modern times of left, what we sometimes refer to as left brain activity, as dominant, taking a dominance over the right brain kind of activities. And finally just did some speed reading through about two-thirds of it that was more detailed than I was able to absorb. I think my left brain wasn't working so well. And kind of finished that one up. And then also just been doing some reading, getting most of the way through Ajahn Jeff's book on Buddhist romanticism, his writings on his reflections, sense that a lot of what is being taught and practiced as Buddhism and as it's come to the West is really more based on the philosophies of the German Romantics, and how that's permeated and developed into our culture, also specifically in the way that some of the teachings or the Buddhist teachings have been interpreted and brought into our Western culture. So these are themes that have been kind of more or less running around in my head these days. But it's been interesting. Some of it I kind of gloss over myself, and maybe some of it isn't so applicable to here and now practice, but it is interesting to see how some of these teachings or reflections or musings really seem to be manifesting these days, because I don't think there's any doubt that, there's a lot of sense in modern society of an incredible complexity that seems to be somewhat unique to this time. I can't really say that the actual experience of suffering and its causes is any different than it was 2,500 years ago, or since beginningless time. But that at different times, there's different ways that these things manifest, and that the modern society here and now where we live is very complex, and a lot of it maybe got started with, say, the Industrial Revolution and the mechanization of society, you know, the movement towards more materialistic ease, focusing on the physical world, and the whole nature of society, and particularly the last several decades, as information technology has grown immensely, the world has been reorienting itself very rapidly towards information exchange, and just the results of what that's done and how that's affected people's spiritual experiences as well, and the kinds of answers to spiritual questions, the searches that people are going through and looking for answers, explanations, ways of orienting themselves in a rapidly changing world. And I think a lot of spiritual interest has come from this dis-ease, this growing sense that there's something's out of control, you know, something's not right. The wheel is turning too fast, it's too unbalanced. How did I get here? What to do? Often expressed as a real sense of disconnectedness from the world, disconnectedness from society, from inclusive human values, a sense of alienation or fragmentation, maybe. But this sense of a rapidly changing way that we operate in the world, increasingly disconnected from other human beings, you know, just our abilities to do so much without actually contacting, being in contact with other beings. The world of work and entertainment and even, you know, how we acquire material things can all be done from our desk in our office or in our home, without even contacting the world, just having a sense of not even being connected to how we acquire material objects. You know, it's a far, far cry from the systems of, you know, bartering or exchanging goods in markets, even though that still, of course, happens. But the rapid change and disconnection from what it is that we consume and actually where it actually came from. You know, much of what we buy and consume now comes from multiple places across the world. And the sense of localness is quite diminished. So most of us don't even know, you know, the web of exchanges and interactions that go to just bring ourselves the material goods that we can now have such easy access to, instantaneous access to almost. Sense of disconnection from the whole process of how the world works. The amount of information is overwhelming. Probably everybody has experienced that. Just trying to sift through and sort through all the masses and masses of information. You know, I can see it in myself and see it in other people. Just, you know, trying to find something on the internet, and you know, you open up one page and there's just massive amounts of information about one thing. And I think the tendency is just to short circuit. You know, our brains just kind of can't take it all in. And so we become less attentive. We move faster, sifting through large bits of information and dismissing things and not even actually reading things and thereby missing sometimes what it is we're actually looking for. It's just too much TMI, too much information. Contributes to that sense of confusion, disconnectedness, and encourages us to focus just on getting what we want and getting it as quickly as we can. Yeah, and just sort of a confusion around values, what's important to us, because, you know, with the ready access, yeah, there's a lot of good things that have come out of the material development and the information exchange. You know, we hear it all the time, actually. We're part of that. We have our website and reach a lot of people through the internet and that whole thing. And there's a lot of good stuff that comes. People who wouldn't have access to these teachings, you know, these reflections on Saturday and One Pran nights. You know, people now who live in rural areas of Iowa have access to some Dhamma. So there's good stuff that comes from all of this, and we can see the value of that. It's also, on a material level, it's the rapidity and ease is addicting because it satisfies some very basic drives in a much quicker way, so that we can, you know, get more instantaneous gratification in all sorts of ways with the technology the way it is now. So it reinforces this sense of, you know, how do I get my temporary pleasures as quickly as possible? You know, we've certainly taken the waiting out of wanting, as that American Express advertisement used to say. We've accomplished that very well. So it's really reinforced this particular value, wish, drive for material well-being with some of its positive sides. But, you know, competing is that, a competing value in our lives is just that that wishing for a sense of a little bit more connection with the world, with the people. We've lost some of that human element, those qualities of contact, interaction, a slower way of the world that allows for a more relaxed, easeful, spacious, integrated sense of well-being. So in some of the readings that I've been doing, this is this conflict in values has been kind of expressed as a basis for a spiritual search. And it's often taken in, you know, recent years, and particularly Ajahn Jeff makes his arguments and statements based on the fact that the romantic ideals, which I'm not planning to go into a whole lot tonight, but that's kind of been the attraction of people who are interested in answering some of these problems of feeling alienated, fragmented, disconnected, that these philosophical teachings and views arose out of this kind of disaffectation with the way the world has been going. And that a lot of spiritual practice these kinds of teachings have come about through this wish to reintegrate the personality, to bring it back to wholeness, to undo this sense of fragmentation and disconnectedness and confusion with all these competing values, to try and pull it back together, to reintegrate it into a sense of completeness and a return to, you know, the more broad perspective of what this other author was calling, you know, right hemisphere activity, right brain activity, that which integrates and sees the whole rather than divides and fragments. And that this has driven a lot of spiritual searching and has even influenced strongly the way some of the ways that the Buddha's teachings have come to be practiced and taught in the West. So that there's this, you know, there's been a strong psychological orientation coming to some of the teachings as a way of using some of the teachings to help reintegrate the personality, to bring some of the meditation, particularly the meditation practice, as a way of slowing down, reducing stress, seeing things more clearly, and providing a sense of more stability and calm and ability to handle data, information, multiple stimulations, to be able to handle them in a way that's not so overwhelming to the individual. Again, reintegrating some of these divisive aspects of our experience. And also for those people who are interested on the broader spiritual level, broader perspective, bringing that sense of wholeness and oneness into more of a greater arena of consciousness, you know, the teachings on expanding one's consciousness through meditative practices and attaining kind of a oneness, those who take that beyond the psychological integration, taking it to a oneness with all other beings on the planet, the reflections that are often being taught of seeing oneself in conjunction with all of humanity, being part of a web of interdependence, of interconnectedness, that all actions affect the whole, all actions are part of the whole, and that it's our duty to try and realize our connectedness with all of the beings, all other beings, and the planetary forces, the natural forces of the world, as a way of reintegrating ourselves and resensitizing ourselves to the world. Because part of the spiritual dilemma is also this detachment from or lack of contact with the natural forces. That's been part of the problem as well, the industrialization, the mechanization, the information explosion has all brought us away from the natural experience of the world, the cycles of life and death and of nature. So a lot of the teachings and what, you know, we've been hearing in many Western spiritual circles is one of how to try and reintegrate all of these aspects of our experience. And sometimes what you see is this kind of, you know, very hopeful and positive attitude and this promise in a way of, well, I can have it all. You know, it's almost too hard to reconcile this wish for material comfort, ease, rapid gratification. And we don't want to give that up because it's very pleasurable, very pleasant. But we also want that sense of wholeness and that feeling of relaxation and integration. And sometimes the message is, well, you can have it all. So we grab onto that and we operate, you know, trying to have the best integrated life. We have our, you know, great careers and our lovely social situations and our great families and all the activities and material successes. We spend time striving for that and try and also, you know, be the perfect spiritually realized being who's, you know, in communion with the world and there to help all sentient beings. Boy, you know, what a tall order. This makes me kind of exhausted thinking about it. Trying to have it all, and that this is what the potential, if we can just get it right. So you see that goal being worked worked towards in many circles and being espoused in many circles. And that's it. That if we can do that, then we've realized the fullness of the human potential. But as we all know, I think, at least all of us who are in this room anyway, that's not what the Buddha was teaching. Because anything like that is still, even to the highest level of developing a spiritual capacity to experience oneness, all of that is still within the realm of becoming. And whatever arises ceases as well. The characteristic of impermanence is always present, even when we think we've got it all, when we've even experienced sublime spiritual attainments, expansion of consciousness. It's all subject to impermanence, change, because it's all based on that sense of wanting to get something, wanting to be something. And as the Buddha teaches us in the Four Noble Truths, that's the cause for suffering, the cause for dissatisfaction, unsatisfactoriness. This is tanha, this craving. So the reality is that if at least we're looking for a release from that suffering, from that unsatisfactoriness, then we can't have it all. That's the kind of the bottom line. And that's what is sometimes hard to accept, I think, in modern society with all the promises. The truth is that we really can't have it all, and that if we want to experience some sense of real, truthful release from these patterns and this disintegration of our being, then we have to be willing to start to relinquish some of these things. Lungpa was talking last night about relinquishment, and that the teachings are very much oriented towards non-acquisition, but in terms of letting go, so that we're not orienting ourselves to have it all, to become the best, to become the most integrated internally, or the most expanded consciousness that is possible. Our task is to understand the causes of suffering and to learn how to respond to the instincts to acquire, to become, that cause the suffering. And this is one of the things that seems to be lacking in some of the ways the teachings have come to the West, is really not a sense of appreciation or a focus on the transcendent aspects of the teaching. Oftentimes it's talked about the orientations or the manifestations of practice in terms of like immanence versus transcendence, the conditioned world versus the ability to transcend that, how things manifest in the world, and then the ability to move beyond that, transcend that. And rather than trying to find perfection in the immanent, in the manifested world, and to try and find the perfect interior integration and the perfect way to work in harmony with nature and the balance of the world, rather than using that as our final goal, we're using what's available to us in the conditioned realm to help us understand the way to move beyond conditions, to what the Buddha terms as release from the realm of samsara, the realms of becoming, to the unconditioned. So rather than trying to perfect the world, the interior world and the exterior world, we're trying to use them in ways that help us to move beyond them. So the goal becomes different. It doesn't become one where we are oriented towards trying to take care of all of our neuroses and tendencies and become the perfect psychologically integrated being, or to realize, you know, oneness with the rest of the world of humanity and nature and all of experience. It becomes one of looking to see how our absorption in this quest of becoming, of always wanting things to be better, gets in the way of our letting go of the habits that keep us engaged in this whole process altogether. So we learn to use the conditioned realm, the immanent, as a way to transcend it. And the Buddha talks about different ways that we do that, and one of the ways, you know, kind of the bridge in some ways, is this using skillful means, skillful reflections, to help start to still the mind enough so that we can reflect on the causes of our involvement in habits that lead us into dissatisfaction, to unsatisfactoriness. We have to have a relatively stable and clear mind to be able to do that. Of course, we also have to, primarily, we have to have right view. We have to have a view that there is some reason to do that, that it doesn't all just end with this particular life, that this has been going on for since beginningless time through multiple lives. We have to reflect on that and have some sort of at least working acceptance of that, even if we don't have firsthand experience. Otherwise, what's the motivation to go beyond anything other than temporal happiness to get us through this one life and then it's all over with, which would be great if I could convince myself of that. But a reflective acceptance based on the teachings that this has been going on for a long time and is bound to keep on going on for many lifetimes if we don't address it, gives quite a bit of oomph to motivation in the practice. So that's part of right view and the acceptance that what we do makes a difference, that there is karma, there is the results of actions that we take, so that we actually have some individual control. We're not just a helpless particle of a massive universe, you know, without any kind of individual ability to affect our experience. This is the acceptance of the law of karma, and then the understanding that we have the capacity to work our way out of this mess of samsara. So reflecting on that, but developing a sense of clarity and calmness and peace of mind, not just for the stress that it releases, the stress that it reduces, but for the ability to be able to really penetrate these truths deeply. And to do that, we have to use what we've got in the world around us to help clear the way, to help settle the mind, to help develop a sense of peacefulness and clarity, so that we can wisely reflect on these things. We do that, you know, as we gladden the mind. There's all the reflections on the virtuous aspects of our lives. We do learn to do things in a skillful way. There are skillful things that we can do in our lives as part of the conditioned realm to help set the stage, help pave the way. All the practices, of course, that we know of, the practicing of generosity, giving, service, virtuous conduct, reflections on the different teachings. All of these settle the mind, develop a sense of uplift, of ease, of gladness. That is the first stage of preparing the mind to be able to see deeply. So these are all things within the realm of the immanent that we use to uplift the mind, give a sense of ease and well-being on a temporal level. There's also been a couple of discussions recently and talk that Ajahn Janako was mentioning from Ajahn Sumedho about, say, the use of things like art, or in my mind also like music, different kinds of things like that of that bring a more refined sense of uplift. You know, we have to let go sometimes of the coarse things in our lives, or the things that have given us pleasures in the past, pick up things that bring us to a more attuned or a higher level. It's kind of like kind of getting out of the sandbox and into school. And, you know, things like art and music, if done with spiritual application, can, you know, uplift the mind in a spiritual way, I think. It's using these elements of the world, the conditioned world, to help move us in that direction. You know, Ajahn Sumedho was kind of wryly reflecting that he didn't really have much of an artistic bent himself. Yeah, referring, I think, to Ajahn Vee's ability to do craftsmanship, and was realizing that he didn't have that craftsman's bone in his body at all. And yeah, I'm similar. I don't have any kind of artistic abilities whatsoever. Not an artistic bone in my body, really. Yeah, and but just that, you know, that sometimes those things, I think the point he was making was is that if we use them as for ego gratification or for recognition, then that's not going to help very much. But if they're used as a way of uplifting the mind, you know, focusing on a spiritual object, whether it's in visual art or music or these kinds of modes of expression, then that's a way to help gladden the mind as well, bring a sense of uplift and ease. And then like any of the reflections that we can do on group, you know, the other aspects of gratitude or giving or generosity, moral virtue, we use those to set the stage. And then as that causes easefulness in the mind, then we drop those because they are dependent on the realm of the senses in a way, but we use them for that purpose in the sense realm to help lift us into the realm of the mind, where we can then take up a more subtle, neutral object, less dependent on the sense faculties, the physical sense faculties anyway, and then set them aside and allow the uplift and the easefulness to settle on a more neutral object, to develop that sense of quiet, tranquility, calmness that is still dependent on having an object, but less dependent on the world of the senses around us. We use it as a vehicle to move us into that deeper state of tranquility, of concentration, samadhi. And with that ability of clarity and calmness, then we then start to investigate these truths of the world around us, the transience, the unsatisfactoriness. And that basis gives us the ability and the, in a way, the bravery to start relinquishing, to start letting go. And this is what brings a sense of sustained fulfillment, a sustained integration of connectedness. It's this process of letting go of what it is that we think will give us satisfaction. But being part of the conditioned realm never really can. It can never really fully satisfy, no matter how lofty. So it's using this, in a way, it's using this immanence to lead us to the transcendent. So there's, you know, structures that we can set up in our lives to help us do this too. And kind of the basis for really developing a sense of a firmness and solidity and conviction, faith, establishing ourselves solidly into the practice are what the Buddha talks about as the four factors that are necessary for the development of conviction. And they actually directly address some of the problems that I think society has been experiencing in the modern world as this confusion and lack of spiritual integration. And as starting to develop this sense of conviction, we need to have this support of people around us. So the association with wise and learned, well-practiced people in the Buddha's teachings, in the Dhamma. And that in itself is an answer to this, one of the answers to this problem of lack of connectedness. We start to establish connections with people that we see have really developed themselves in a way that we want to as well. We see, you know, from people who have practiced Dhamma, we see the effects. We see the well-being, the sense of ease, the lightness, and the integration of well-practiced people. And we want to emulate that. We want to learn from that. We want to be around that. So we find our spiritual community, such as right here. We're so lucky to be in a group of people who really have a sincere interest in the teachings and where they can take us, and who have put it into practice full time. So we seek to commune with each other and to support each other, and it's indispensable. It's I think the Buddha referred to wise spiritual company as the most important external way to develop in the practice. So we have to pull that into our lives, and that in itself answers one of the primary issues of this feeling of disconnectedness from the world. And we actually put ourselves in the presence of other beings and ones that will support us in this as well. And then we listen to the teachings. We really listen clearly with eager ears, and we really bring them into our lives, into our practice. We have to have a sincere effort to do that. And then we have to essentially put them into practice, attend wisely. That's the third one, is this yoniso manasikara, to really use appropriate attention, wise reflection, to bring the teachings in. Buddha talks about that being the most important internal quality to bring into our lives to develop the practice, is wise attention, appropriate attention, so that we actually put it into action, put it into practice. We learn, you know, what kinds of reflections to engage in, which ones not to, which ones will just take us into confusion, chaos, speculations about the world and our place in it, the nature of the self, all of these kinds of speculative questionings we set aside. We engage in more pertinent reflections, such as the Four Noble Truths. What is suffering really like? Really investigating, penetrating deep into the nature of our dissatisfaction and the causes for it, the craving, and then the path leading to the end of that. We really investigate, put our attention there, apply the teachings. And then maybe most importantly, in the context of this greater society, what we've been talking about in the spiritual practices that people are taking up, we learn to practice in accordance with Dhamma and to really investigate the teachings that we're hearing, the teachings that we're exploring, the ways that the teachings are being presented in the West, and say, well, is this really in accordance with the Dhamma? Does it really coincide with the teachings about how to recognize dukkha and how we can understand and abandon the cause of dukkha and how we can realize the complete cessation of all suffering. Does what I'm hearing, what I'm listening to, what I'm contemplating, the views and practices and opinions and ideas and values that I'm adopting, the way that I'm living my life, is that in accordance with the teachings? Does it help me move towards the goal? Or does it maybe just give me some kind of satisfaction of a little bit better life? So we have to be honest with ourselves and ask us what it is that we really want, where we really want to go. Are we, you know, interested in just some, you know, greater sense of ease, well-being, less stressful life, maybe a little bit more connectedness with the world around us, and some meditative, you know, blissful experiences? Or are we really interested in penetrating the cause of how we've gotten ourselves deeply enmeshed in the world of suffering, and how to get out of it, how to transcend it? So we have to be honest with ourselves. What is it that we're really wanting to do? And then practice in accordance with that. And if we really want to help the world, you know, if we really want to, you know, do the best we can to ease the pain and the difficulty and the suffering and the disconnectedness and the crazy ways that we operate in the world, and the damage that we do to the rest of the world through our own acquisitiveness, then realizing the teachings on a very individual level, putting them into practice and realizing the fruits, is the best thing we can do, because then we can share that with other people. That's the highest gift. That's the best thing we can do to solve the problems of the world. So it all begins with our individual motivation, our individual understanding, and the willingness to really look honestly at where we are, how we've gotten here, what it is that we really are seeking, giving up the short-term goals and immediate sense of well-being, and letting go, relinquishing that which we don't need to hold on to any longer, towards the pursuit of a longer, more stable, lasting sense of peace and contentment. So that's what we're all presumably here doing on this winter retreat, the chance to really go deep, to investigate our motivations, and then to really pick up the teachings, all the practical aspects of the path, developing them, really moving inwards, exploring, trying new things that help move us in that direction. That's what we're here to do. We've got taken 1 month so far and another 2 months to go. So there's still wide open space to really move deeply and develop the path. So on the eve of my heading up to Pacific Hermitage in a few days, I just want to really encourage and encourage people to just really take the ball, go with it. We've got this great opportunity, perfect setting, perfect teachers, perfect teachings, great support. We've got all the requisites, and it's up to us to put it all into practice and make the best use of our time. So I'll leave that for tonight. Mm-hmm.